Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. President-elect Biden moves ahead with a transition as President Trump's moves to reverse the election results take a potentially dangerous turn. Then, a surging crisis with COVID cases spiking across the country and hospitals reaching capacity, we talk with the governor of New Mexico about grappling with the pandemic. And it's Friday. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the president's firing of a top security official, legal challenges to the election results, and refusal to concede defeat. Plus, Dolly Parton talks with us about her new book, a Christmas special, and offers her timeless wisdom.
Some good things about getting older is that you can look back on your life and see what you've accomplished and see what you can do to help other people on their journey, which is what I'm doing right now.
All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. President-elect Joe Biden is nearing 80 million votes in the presidential election count tonight, nearly 6 million more than President Trump. But Mr. Trump still shows no signs of conceding. Instead, he is pressing lower-level Republicans to try to overturn the results. Lisa Desjardins reports.
Welcome to Wilmington.
In Wilmington, Delaware, a show of unity and talk of governing, as President-elect Joe Biden spent part of his 78th birthday meeting with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Democratic Senate Leader Chuck Schumer. Among their topics, coronavirus relief.
In my Oval Office, you're mi casa, you casa. I hope we're going to spend a lot of time together.
At the White House today, President Trump was in policy mode too, with his first public remarks in a week, this time at an event about drug prices, but which he pivoted to the election.
Big Pharma ran millions of dollars of negative advertisements against me during the campaign, which I won, by the way, but, you know, we'll find that out.
Yet another note in the president's operetta of denial, as outside officials plainly affirm that Mr. Trump has lost his bid for a second term. After a six-day hand tally of ballots, the state of Georgia certified its election results that President-elect Biden won the Peach State and its 16 Electoral College votes. Georgia's Republican Secretary of State defended the vote count last night.
As Secretary of State, I believe that the numbers that we have presented today are correct. The numbers reflect the verdict of the people, not a decision by the Secretary of State's office or of courts or of either campaigns.
Will you let Trump intimidate you into changing your mind?
This as Republicans in Michigan are being singled out by the White House and by protesters. Michigan State Senate Leader Mike Shirky passed a handful of demonstrators at the airport after President Trump personally asked him to come to the White House. The state is scheduled to certify Monday, and the Trump campaign has openly raised the idea of subverting popular vote results it disputes by getting GOP legislatures like Michigan's to overturn them. White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany also didn't dismiss the idea of the president asking individual electors to break with their state and vote for him.
The president, again, is pursuing ongoing litigation, taking it day by day, and we'll wait for that litigation to play out. There's an entire constitutional process of electors casting their ballots, and I will leave that to the president.
Michigan Congresswoman Debbie Dingell condemned the idea.
It's clearly an attempt by the president to change the results of the elections. Let me be very clear. This goes beyond partisan politics, and it's an attempt to subvert our democracy and undermine the will of Michigan voters. If we do not certify the results on Monday, they are breaking the law.
Outrage is coming from a few members of the president's own party, too. Utah Senator Mitt Romney tweeted, "It is difficult to imagine a worse, more undemocratic action by a sitting American president." In a statement, Nebraska Senator Ben Sasse wrote, "Trump campaign lawyers have stood before courts under oath. They have repeatedly refused to actually allege grand fraud because there are legal consequences for lying to judges." Now, nearly 2 weeks from Biden being declared the winner, it is still unclear when any formal White House transition will begin.
And Lisa joins me now along with Yamiche Alcindor. So Yamiche, to you first, as we just heard in Lisa's report, the president is meeting with these Michigan state officials today on the same day Georgia certifies its results for Joe Biden. Tell us what the president's strategy is here.
We end this week much like we began it, with the president insisting that he won the 2020 election without providing any evidence to prove that. And he's continuing to not acknowledge that Joe Biden is the president-elect. And he's doing all this while having a strategy that is becoming more brazen and more bold, and as people in his inner circle continue to get sicker and sicker. So now tonight we have reports that Donald Trump Jr., his son, has COVID-19. That adds to a long list of people, including the White House chief of staff, including the White House press secretary, the president himself, and a number of others who have had the virus as they've continued to keep up this fight. Critics of the president say what we're witnessing here with President Trump is someone who is trying to subvert American democracy, someone who is trying to undo the very foundation of America. Now, tonight, the president had two top Michigan officials at the White House. I'm told they were here this afternoon, that they left a short time ago. It's not clear what exactly was said in that meeting, but what we do know is that the president has been openly saying that Michigan officials and other officials should be trying to overturn the results, and that these states should, in fact, be given to him as a winner. Now, Joe Biden won the state of Michigan by 150,000 votes. And when the White House press secretary, Kayleigh McEnany, was questioned about this meeting that just took place, she said, quote, "This is not an advocacy meeting, and there are no campaign officials in that meeting." Of course, Judy, what we both know is that the candidate was in that meeting, President Trump. So he, of course, was advocating for himself. Another thing that's happening here is the White House continues to be on defense. The president today came to the White House podium to talk about lowering prescription drug prices. But in that, he slid in there, "I won the election." So that's the president continuing to double down. Now, as we're continuing to follow this, all eyes continue to be on the GSA, Emily Murphy, someone who's supposed to be signing off on the transition officially. As of now, that process remains frozen, and we have to continue to watch that space to see if anything changes.
General Services Administration, Yamiche, thank you for that. And Lisa, what is the Biden team saying about all this? How concerned are they?
Well, two fronts. Let's talk first about the idea of governing. The Biden transition spokesperson, Jen Psaki, today told reporters that patience, in her words, is starting to run out. There's a shared running out of patience. Now, this is the week where Biden transition team is, some of them, moving their emails over from the campaign to the transition. And those 500 people that are on agency review teams that the Biden staff has set up, they were hoping to reach out to their agency counterparts. That's not happening. Let's talk about the other front. That's the legal front. This is where we heard some very sharp words and pushback from the Biden team today. Bob Bauer, speaking for them, their attorney, said no state legislature in the country's history has done what President Trump seems to be asking the Michigan state legislators to do, which is overturn the certified results that we expect to be certified Monday of a popular election. The Biden campaign basically is saying this is not legal and it doesn't have any historical precedent. They say they're not concerned about the election being overturned, nor have they ever been. But they also say it's dangerous. And they point out one other thing. They say that the Trump campaign has shown a discriminatory pattern, that they are particularly going after challenges in African-American areas, cities, that they think shows a very serious bias problem. And that's something that they say they will continue to raise in court to every Trump filing.
These are heavily Democratic cities. Lisa Desjardins, Yamiche Alcindor, reporting on today's extraordinary events. Thank you both.
Welcome.
And we continue our look at the president's actions and the state of the Republican Party with former Arizona GOP Senator Jeff Flake. Senator Flake, thank you so much for being with us. So we have the president still refusing to concede, insisting that he won, in constant motion to try to overturn the results today, meeting with state officials from Michigan. What do you make of all this?
Well, it's frankly just awful. It's awful for the country and for Republicans. It's terrible as well. So I don't understand it. I'm grateful that some Republicans are finally starting to speak up. I wish more of them would. This is unprecedented, and it just does not speak well, obviously, for the president or for the party.
We heard there are some who are saying this is literally dangerous for our democracy. Do you share that view?
Uh, I'm sorry, we're cutting up here.
I think we're having a connection. Having a connection issue. Let me try one more time. Speaking with former Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona. Senator, do you believe this is dangerous for our democracy, what the president is trying to do?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question. We cut out for a second.
Let me just try.
Go ahead.
Apologies. Let me try one more time at that technology. Is this dangerous for democracy?
Yeah. It is. It is. When you have the rest of the world looking at us and watching this closely, frankly, and when we, try to be an example for the rest of the world, if other countries were doing what the president is doing, if other leaders were doing what the president is doing, we would be very critical. We have been in the past. And so this doesn't speak well for us. It's a very difficult time. I hope we can get past it quickly. And I'm confident we will by the time the inauguration rolls around.
The president, Senator Flake, insisting that what his lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, is saying is true. We heard Giuliani yesterday making false claims about conspiracy theories, about Venezuela, about the Clintons, and on and on. Is any of that, does any of it have any connection to anything that's real?
I'm sorry, I probably only heard part of the question there. But yes, these claims are demonstrably false. They're so far out that I don't know how anybody, frankly, can believe them. But the president knows that some Republicans will. And it's similar to the birtherism theory. I don't think the president ever believed that Barack Obama was not a citizen, but he knew that a lot of Republicans would, and he used it. And he's doing the same thing now.
Senator Jeff Flake, would love to talk to you a little bit more, but I think we are having technical problems. Thank you so much for talking with us. In the day's other news, drug maker Pfizer applied for an emergency use authorization for its COVID-19 vaccine in the U.S. If the so-called EUA is approved, vaccinations could begin next month on a limited basis. In dueling TV interviews today, the Trump administration touted its vaccine plan, while President-elect Biden's team argued that it is not getting accurate numbers or information.
We have about 40 million doses of vaccine, give or take, exactly when the EUA comes out. And what we're going to do is we're going to execute fair and equitable distribution based on the population of the jurisdictions identified as the 50 states, 8 territories, and 6 metropolitan cities.
There was a plan for 300 million doses to be available at the end of the year. What they're reporting now is 20 to 30 million doses available. Why? Where are the bottlenecks? What are the shortages? How are they addressing them? And what are the gaps that then the next administration needs to fill? That alone means delays that could cost lives.
The country is averaging more than 1,300 deaths a day from COVID, with a new record of nearly 188,000 new cases on Thursday alone. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin is rejecting criticism after he ended some pandemic emergency lending at the Federal Reserve. In a rare rebuke, the Fed said Thursday evening that it needs every tool to shore up the economy. Mnuchin shot back today, quote, saying that is not their job. He also denied trying to limit President-elect Biden's economic options. The UN Refugee Agency warned today that fighting in northern Ethiopia could create 200,000 refugees in the next 6 months. Ethiopia's military is battling rebel forces in the Tigray region, and hundreds of people have been killed. At least 32,000 refugees have already fled to Sudan. American Jonathan Pollard, who sold U.S. secrets to Israel in the 1980s, completed his parole today. The Justice Department opted not to continue restrictions on his movements, freeing him to go to Israel, which has long lobbied for his cause. He was released from a U.S. prison in 2015 after 30 years. Some of the material stolen by Pollard ended up in the Soviet Union, including information on U.S. informants. The Trump administration has issued new rules to cut drug costs for seniors as of January 1st. Medicare would pay the same as the lowest price in other advanced countries, and drug makers would pay rebates to Medicare enrollees instead of to insurers. The industry is expected to fight the changes in court. And Wall Street, most of Wall Street, retreated today amid worries about rising COVID infections. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 219 points to close at 29,263. The Nasdaq rose 49 points, and the S&P 500 slid 24. Still to come on the NewsHour, the governor of New Mexico discusses the troubling surge in COVID cases. Mark Shields and David Brooks analyze the president's continued refusal to concede defeat. And Dolly Parton on her new book and being more productive than ever.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
As coronavirus cases across the country continue to rise, only three states currently have a stay-at-home or curfew order in place. Amna Nawaz talked to the leader of one state under lockdown.
It took nearly 100 days for New Mexico to reach its first 10,000 coronavirus cases, but the state went from 60,000 to 70,000 in just 7 days. Today, COVID numbers there are increasing exponentially, and hospitals are at 90 to 100% capacity. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham issued stay-at-home orders earlier this week, and she's called the state legislature into special session to deal with the virus's spread and the economic fallout. She joins us now. Governor, welcome back to the NewsHour, and thank you for making the time. We should mention the total number of COVID cases in New Mexico now top 74,000, deaths there top 1,300. You've had to call in traveling nurses, brought in mortuary trailers. You need this shutdown to work right now. And previously you said enforcement was part of the problem. How about now? Is it different? Are you able to enforce this shutdown?
So it depends on personal compliance, really incredibly hard to attain in any state. This one's no different. We've had a mandatory mask mandate since May. Getting our businesses to support us more productively, I think has been a bit of a challenge, but I have to say, today, they get it. And we've been incredibly firm about if you've got four different rapid responses, positive case, we come in, we close for 24 hours, get everybody tested. If you get four of those in a two-week period, you're closed for 2 weeks. And so they're now really coming to the table with solutions. So I'm feeling better about enforcement and compliance, but we need a reset in our state, and we are going to get it.
What about on the individual level, especially with the Thanksgiving holiday coming up? The virus spread there, we know, is largely due to these small kind of family gatherings. You're asking people in New Mexico to limit their gatherings to five. How do you begin to enforce that?
So you ask one of the most important questions. You can't enforce that. There is no way anywhere in the country we're going to be able to say, look, you brought another household together. There was 10 of you having Thanksgiving dinner. But we are hopeful that people will really take heed. You know, we lost our first child in New Mexico. We have more in the hospital. This deadly virus doesn't care how old you are. It doesn't care who you are, where you live, your political affiliation. And we are very nervous about what Thanksgiving could produce right a month later. And we've been doing as much productive messaging. And while we appreciate that Dr. Fauci is doing that, this is really what the federal government did by telling people you don't have to listen to your governors. You don't have to care about public health issues or the public health order. And this virus is a hoax. And it just gives people an opportunity to say, we don't have to worry about it. And that is the most dangerous set of circumstances moving forward until we get a vaccine. So we're nervous, but we're doing all the right messaging. And that's part of the reset, right? If you limit where people go after they've been exposed, then I can limit the spread of the virus. So we're taking all of that into consideration.
Well, New Mexico's seen the same trends we've seen nationwide, right, which is that disproportionately Black and Brown and Native communities have been hit. The Navajo Nation, for example, has had some of the highest per capita infection rates in the country. How are you helping this community? What additional steps are you taking in coordination with your neighbors in Arizona and Utah and Colorado, surging help to these specific communities? What specifically are you doing there?
Well, I would say actually New Mexico has been very effective and led. I'd like to say, without diminishing the very difficult challenges and decisions the governors and the states that neighbor us, Utah and Arizona, where the Navajo Nation is embedded in all three states, we have not been as effective coordinating. And again, the Indian Health Service, which is the federal effort here, is also not coordinating, and they're not very supportive. We have a very strong relationship with the Navajo Nation. So they have a very strict set of containment issues, and we are engaged in that. We provide traffic support, food, water, personal supplies, educational supports, testing, contact tracing. We're doing that. And we've crushed this virus in Indian country in New Mexico three times. And we were lucky not to have it get into every single tribal community. I don't think we're going to be that lucky this time. Given the rhetoric right up until the election, it just created that perfect storm. What happens around the country and what happens in the other states will find its way right back here. So basically, all of those tribal nations are containing themselves. We're providing all the necessary supports so that they can do that effectively. But it's been really tough, and I give them great credit for their leadership and courageous actions, which no question are saving lives in New Mexico.
Governor, we should mention you are also now part of the Biden-Harris transition team. You were on a call just yesterday with a number of governors and President-elect Biden and Vice President-elect Harris. You discussed, among other things, the pandemic response. And I'm curious, without the official transition in place, without that coordination, particularly when your state and so many others are facing this dire situation with the pandemic response, do you think that the transition should be doing more to force cooperation? They mentioned legal options being on the table. Do you want to see them force those kind of options, specifically when it comes to pandemic cooperation?
You know, I have to say, I think the Biden-Harris team is doing this right, and I know we're all frustrated. And the fact that the current occupant in the White House is behaving in this untenable way, which will result in more deaths from the pandemic and, frankly, more economic harm, which means it'll take us longer to address all of that. And that's before we talk about the complications for vaccine distribution in each of the states. I think that what Biden and Harris are trying to do, and I agree with them, is build support from the ground up at the state level. We're making all the decisions. We're doing all the execution of efforts because we're not getting any help from the federal government. And I think, and I agree, that they see that as the quickest way to get Congress to act. It's the quickest way to get information. The National Governors Association is going to provide data about our hospitals, about our plans, about our efforts, about our infection rates, about our cases per 100,000. I mean, all the kinds of outbreak strategies that get you ahead. Because here's what happened. We don't want any of these false choices. I want a strong economy and I want to save lives. But if you don't have people who believe the virus is real, then you end up teeter-tottering between those two parameters. We don't want to do that. What I need is a president who believes that public health efforts can and will work, who will model that behavior nationwide, who will work with each of the governors to bolster their responses, who will create regional systems that keep me, right, not having to fall apart when something goes on in Arizona and Texas and vice versa. So the Arizona and Texas get the supports that they need. That makes sense to me. And they're very clear. We have to have robust testing and contact tracing for another year, all the way through a vaccine distribution. I felt very optimistic, and every governor weighed in about needing a stimulus package. And this is an administration that is dedicated to that priority immediately. I think that's the real focus. That's going to make a huge difference in trust, credibility, and getting the pandemic under control.
Governor, we're wishing you and everyone in New Mexico a safe Thanksgiving holiday. And thank you very much for your time. That's New Mexico's Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham.
Thank you.
The
This week on America Interrupted from the PBS NewsHour, school in a pandemic.
It was becoming too stressful. There was just too many fights, too many meltdowns.
A parent, her daughters, and their teacher share what they're going through. The health concerns, challenges with teaching and learning online, and never knowing what's coming next.
I'm not 100% here as a teacher. I'm not 100% at home. I just don't feel successful anywhere.
Listen and subscribe to America Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts.
We've said this before, but this truly has been a week like no other in U.S. politics. To help us sift through it all, the analysis of Shields and Brooks. That is syndicated columnist Mark Shields and New York Times columnist David Brooks. Hello to both of you on this Friday evening. David, it's been almost 2 weeks since Joe Biden was declared the winner of this election. President Trump still says he won by a landslide, and he seems to be doing everything he possibly can to change the result and get himself reelected. What is going on?
Yeah, the Trump administration is a bit like the COVID pandemic. You can see the light at the end of the tunnel, but the worst, the last chapter is just the worst. This has been the most unsuccessful, the most just horrible in every way transition of power in American history, surpassing Rutherford B. Hayes in 1870 by a country mile. He's throwing everything at it. I don't think there's really much chance he's going to be successful in any ways for a million reasons I could get into. But a friend of mine, Jonathan Rauch, says it's like the fire hose of falsehood strategies that disinformation campaigns use and have used against the United States. And that is where you just fill the air with lies. It's not necessarily that people believe your lies. It's that people don't believe in anything. And so the long-term effect on American society, American politics, and American culture is a country that's even more cynical, even more disabused, and where you have a majority of Republicans right now who think that Trump won. And what does that mean for the next 4 years? It's just a poisonous spewing that should not be underestimated.
Mark, how do you make sense of all this, or do you?
First of all, I'd like to associate with myself with the previous gentleman's remarks. I think David makes great sense. Joe Biden, who has been the model of restraint, said that the president's actions were irresponsible. They are irresponsible, but they're also reprehensible. The president shows absolutely no concern for the president-elect and his group's effort to prepare, to govern, to lead the country. Just go through the myriad of problems facing the country. He has refused to support a COVID relief bill with benefits running out just after Christmas. He has no interest in that, does the president? The president has had no interest in showing the new incoming administration its best way of providing the vaccine to the millions of Americans who so desperately will need it. It's oblivious to national security opportunistic moments that our enemies and those who wish us ill in the world can take advantage across the board. And what David said, I mean, he's sowing doubt and mistrust. Americans historically, Judy, have given the benefit of the doubt to every new president. I mean, it's a wonderful quality of ours. Even we swallow partisanship. What Donald Trump is doing is his best through his 90 million Twitter followers is to reach the 70 million plus who voted for him and say, don't trust. Don't trust your government. Don't trust your nation. And it's reprehensible. It's beyond irresponsible.
David, but it's not just that they're saying that there was a problem here or a problem there. They're alleging massive fraud, conspiracy. Rudy Giuliani yesterday speaking about Venezuela being behind a giant conspiracy, the Clintons, and on, fairy tale-like information. I wonder, is this something that you believe the American people are wise enough, smart enough to reject?
I want to say yes, but, you know, this is really what I wonder about. I mean, holding up documents and claiming you have evidence when you have no evidence is literally what Joe McCarthy did. And now we're seeing a repicture of it. And we've always had in this country a paranoid style. Richard Hofstadter wrote a book about this maybe 50 or 60 years ago, the paranoid style of American politics, the John Birch Society, the conspiracies against alleging that the mafia or somebody killed John F. Kennedy. That's always been here. And so that's not new. The question I have, and I don't know the answer to this, is to what extent is that spreading? To what extent is QAnon just become like a large religion out there? And has all the distrust that's built up over the decades now created a paranoid wing that's just bigger than ever before? I just don't know the answer to that. I do know that every time we have an election, we ratchet down our quality of politics. You know, people claim that Barack Obama was a legitimate president. Hillary Clinton and Jimmy Carter said Donald Trump was an illegitimate president. But that's nothing compared to what's happening right now. And how it seeds in the country and how it seeds over the next 4 years, there's some evidence that we're just seeing a bigger, alienated, paranoid wing of our country, and who may believe in this or may just believe in nobody. It's just pure nihilism.
And what makes it more, in my mind, a question, Mark, is that most elected Republican officials are backing the president in what he's doing. They're saying he has every right to challenge. Very few of them are saying what he's doing is wrong.
Judy, they have taken a vow of silence, apparently. The most amazing moment of the week to me politically was to find out that Meet the Press last Sunday called every single Republican senator and invited him or her to be on the show that Sunday. And every one of them turned to Meet the Press down. Now, I mean, that is unheard of, to be invited to an important forum like that. Senators jump at that opportunity historically. And what you're back to is Dante's great quote that the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who, in a time of moral crisis, remain neutral. I mean, that's what they've done. They've taken this vow of silence with conspicuous consumptions. They are enabling him, and they are undoing democracy. And they're doing enormous damage. I mean, saying, well, it just humor them along a little while. We're facing the greatest public health crisis we've had in 100 years. I mean, we're facing an economic crisis of dramatic and historic proportions and dimensions. People's lives are really at risk. And what they do is futz around on this and pretend that we're not going to tell the emperor that he has no trousers on, or that he has no shirt on. There's no attempt to win here. Nobody believes that Donald Trump won the election. It's just to sow doubt and mistrust and distrust. And what a terribly dishonorable objective.
Well, it appears that he believes it, and a number of people who are backing him may believe it. It's not clear. But David, is there, as you look at how Joe Biden has responded to this, the comments that he's made, he's been asked about it day after day. Is there anything, I mean, what do you make of that? Is that a response that is likely to win opinion, win hearts and minds? What do you see? What do you hear?
Well, first, I want to acknowledge the Republicans who actually have stood up. Mitt Romney, first and foremost, Jeff Flake early. But even this week, Lamar Alexander and Ben Sasse, senators from Tennessee and Nebraska, have really put out statements. And so I think they get some credit. As for Joe Biden, I think he's handled it reasonably well, not overreacting, getting down to business, focusing on COVID. That strikes me as very sensible. His transition put out an email today raising money. So we've got a country, we're living in a country where the president-elect has to raise money to pay for the transition because he can't yet get public funds. It's like we're not a first world country anymore.
And David, you mentioned Republicans, but I think it's still the case. Mitch McConnell, the majority of elected Republicans are still not challenging the president.
Yeah, I'd say there are four levels. There's a very small level of heroes like Romney. There's the 80%ers who are sort of moving away. Then there's 90% who are just completely silenced, including, for example, Cory Gardner, the guy who just got defeated in a Senate race, who has nothing left to lose politically, even he's still silent. And then there are the hardcore Giulianis. And right now, you're right, there's that core group of Republicans who are disgraceful in their silence.
Mark, what about Joe Biden and how he is dealing with this? What's your assessment?
I think Joe Biden has handled it well. I mean, you can feel his mounting frustration, a greater sense of urgency as time goes by, and the enormous task confronting him and his administration, and being robbed of the chance just to consult, Judy, just to consult with the people who have been there, who are there, who are working. I mean, it's the Republicans' mantra during impeachment, you recall, was, let's wait until the election. Let's let the voters decide. Let's let them cast their ballots. Well, they've done that. It's time to accept it. I acknowledge Governor Romney's, Senator Romney's leadership, Lamar Alexander, after three terms in his retirement, did make a statement today. And Ben Sasse has, in fact, shown some independence. But that's three. That's three. I'm still waiting for the leadership to move on it and stop pretending. I mean, this is a fantasy land we're living in, but it's a dangerous fantasy land. And we're playing with people's lives. 258,000 Americans are dead because of this pandemic. And the president seems consumed with his own ego, his own vanity. Think about this, Judy. If he were really even shrewd, he would be large-spirited and magnanimous right now and do everything he could and take credit and earned credit for his administration to produce a vaccine in 8 months, 9 months. It's an amazing achievement. Yeah. And it would potentially save millions of lives. But he isn't even anywhere near his interest. That he's not concerned about that at all. I mean, it would be in his interest to go out as a magnanimous and large historic figure and serve his purposes, whatever they are in the future. But instead, he's going out as a small, mean, vindictive, and self-absorbed man.
Yeah, I guess he did make a statement one day this week about the vaccine, the progress made on a vaccine. But, David, I do want to come back to something else the president has done, and that is announced pulling U.S. troops out of the Middle East here in the last weeks, months of his presidency, making moves that raise some questions about where this administration wants to leave U.S. power and what he wants to leave for the next administration.
Yeah, there's no question that America wants to get out of Afghanistan. The question is how. And when you measure that, there's always a conflict between the political forces and the military. And sometimes the military probably wants to stay in a little too long. They're probably a little more confident in their abilities to turn things around than they should be. But I'm really struck by how the military leaders, especially the former militaries, the retireds, have really reacted with apoplexy to the way we're withdrawing. And we're going to get out. But they really think there's no military justification, pure politics and destructive effects in Afghanistan to get out. And for all the young men and women who served there over these many, many years, if we stay in a couple more months and leave a lasting legacy they can be proud of, that certainly is worth it. And so what you see from Trump is what seems to be just pure politics so he can brag.
And Mark, just 30 seconds. Thoughts about the president and the military?
Well, Judy, 2,500 people in Iraq and Afghanistan are too few to fight and too many to die. So that is a strategic decision. But the reality is that we have never had in this country any exit strategy in either Iraq or Afghanistan, the two longest wars in American history. We don't know how to measure what victory or success would be. And that is a failure. It's been a failure of four administrations. And the fact that we got into it with no end strategy, with no insight, is a terrible indictment. And it's the only war since the Mexican-American War of longer than 3 months that America has fought without a draft and with tax cuts instead of tax raises. Both Republican presidents during this war, their principal domestic policy has been to cut taxes. So we've now spent $5 trillion, thousands of lives, and disrupted millions of lives. And I ask for what?
A week that's raised a lot of questions. Mark Shields, David Brooks, we thank you both. United States passed another heartbreaking milestone this week with more than 250,000 lives lost now to COVID-19. As we do every Friday, we remember five of them now. ...64-year-old Isabel Papadimitriou of Dallas, Texas, had a warmness about her that drew people in, said her daughter. Isabel's calling was to help people. She worked as a respiratory therapist for nearly 30 years and had a way of making her patients feel seen, heard, and loved. Family meant everything to Isabel. She always showed up for her children, nephews, and nieces, giving them her love and compassion. After 2 years with the Army, Jim Herber spent more than three decades as a postal worker in his hometown of Sheboygan, Wisconsin. It was a career perfectly suited to his lively personality and commitment to public service. Even in retirement, the 74-year-old sought to help others as a hospice volunteer and loved making new friends as a bartender. In his free time, Jim was an avid outdoorsman. He visited countless national parks and even motorcycled to Alaska. He passed down that love of nature to his four children and eight grandchildren. Emergency room doctor Juan Fitz practiced medicine for 34 years. He cared for his patients at his hospital in Lubbock, Texas, like they were family, said his daughter. A gregarious jokester, his daughter said her dad's laughter would fill a room and that he was the type of person who would give you the shirt off his back. Despite his hectic schedule, Juan, a father and grandfather, always managed to make time for his family from softball games to ski trips. Juan was 67 years old. 70-year-old James McIntyre was a bus operator in Pensacola, Florida for 39 years. His regular passengers knew him for his warmth and kindness. A man of faith, James hoped to one day preach before his own congregation. He often talked about God with his frequent riders, offering words of wisdom or support. It was on his bus where he first set eyes on his wife. The two were together for 36 years. 17-year-old Elvia Ramirez, or Rose to friends, had big plans for life after high school, among them college, an engagement to her longtime boyfriend, and a trip to Disneyland with her younger siblings. Curious and creative, Rose loved learning about her family's Native American history and culture in North Dakota, and spent lots of her free time drawing. She also had a silly side on full display on her social media, where she enlisted her brothers, sisters, and friends in dances and lip syncs. We thank family members who shared these stories with us. Our hearts go out to you as they do to all who've lost loved ones during this pandemic. We end this week focusing on a force in American life, Dolly Parton. Her million-dollar contribution to Vanderbilt University's coronavirus research helped in the development of the promising Moderna vaccine. She has 44 career top 10 country albums, a record for any artist, and more than 100 chart-topping singles over the past 40 years. Now, with a new book and Christmas musical, she told me this week she is more productive than ever before. The story is part of our ongoing arts and culture series, Canvas.
more. Honey, try.
She's here.
Take a leap. You just might fly.
Here.
She's dazzling.
And here.
She's delightful.
I'm kicking up my heels tonight.
And here.
Jolly Christmas. Here you come again.
Everything is coming up Dolly. All part of the Dolly Empire.
You walks right in the door.
You are writing songs, you're singing, you're acting, you are doing philanthropic work, you're running your business, you're producing musicals. What's going on? How do you do this?
Well, I have a lot of passion. I have a lot of spiritual energy and a lot of creative energy, and that's a pretty big force, actually. I have to say that I'm a lot busier now than I was when I first started, because I was just trying to get things going. And I think energy begets energy, and I just love being creative and getting to do things for other people, and especially working during a time like this when everybody's been kind of shut down from their normal life.
That energy may never have been more evident than it is right now with the release of a 19-set DVD collection of her music, A Holly Dolly Christmas, her first holiday release in 30 years.
Cuddle up and close it down.
A musical out next week, Christmas on the Square on Netflix, and a book out this week, Songteller, My Life in Lyrics.
Is there more of you that's the singer, more of you that's the writer? Are they equal parts of who you are?
I have to honestly say that I think I take myself more serious as a songwriter than anything else. There are many writers greater than me, but that's just been the thing that I've seemed to enjoy the most because it's my therapy, it's my pleasure, it's my job, it's my joy.
Dolly Parton grew up the fourth of 12 children in a one-room cabin on the banks of Little Pigeon River in the tiny East Tennessee town of Pittman Center. She began singing as a child on local radio and TV. By 13, she was recording her first records and appeared at the Grand Ole Opry, where Johnny Cash encouraged her to follow her talent. She lives in Nashville. Tennessee has always been home base, and she's kept family and her own life experiences central to her work.
There's also threads of me in everything that I write, almost like little secret pieces of me that even I myself don't really realize, but I have the gift of rhyme and I love to write songs. And I can write other people's sorrows, other people's happiness.
Although we had no money.
She's composed an extraordinary 3,000 songs, including Coat of Many Colors,
Working
9 to 5,
Jolene,
and I Will Always Love You. Dolly became the first country artist to chart a top 20 Billboard across 7 consecutive decades, beginning in the 60s.
You better get to living.
Another Parton passion is literacy. Her Imagination Library, now in its 25th year, will donate the 150 millionth book to children around the world next month. All the result, again, of Parton responding to something close to home.
I am as proud of the Imagination Library as I ever will be, anything I ever do for the rest of my life. And I have told the story many times of how it came to be because of my own father, who couldn't read and write, grew up in a big family in the mountains. And so when I saw how crippled that had made my dad emotionally, I wanted to do something to help him. He just loved being part of that, and he took such pride in it, and that gave me such pride in myself that I could do that for my daddy.
When life is good again, I'll be a better friend.
In this song, When Life is Good Again, released in May, Parton was addressing the pandemic and the crushing effect it's had across the country.
It's affected me in many ways. It's affected my businesses, everything that I stand for. this whole year has taken a major toll on everybody. This is the craziest year I've ever seen in my whole life. I didn't want to be crippled with fear about it, and that I had the freedom and the ability and the equipment to do something about it, so I kept trying to work.
In the music video you released in the spring, you did say at the end, wear a mask.
If wearing a mask is going to keep some germs off of you or somebody else, why not? Even if, you know, some people say it's crazy not to.
We also know this year, Dolly Parton, we've seen a gaping political divide in this country. You live in a very red state, Tennessee. How do you see it there?
I've seen what a great divide it has caused, even within my own family and amongst my own friends. I don't know what to make of how people are acting these days, how we have to take even our political views to such degree to where it just destroying our whole families and our whole lifestyle. So we need to pay a little more attention to being human beings rather than getting so caught up in so much other stuff.
She defines herself as nonpartisan. But Parton does speak out on some important causes like Black Lives Matter.
When someone blatantly asks you, do you think Black Lives Matter? Well, of course Black Lives Matter. We're all God's children. We all have a place in this world. We all need to be loved and respected.
In the 1980 feature film, 9 to 5, Parton championed the rights of working women. She told me about her own approach to overcoming barriers, making music, and running her empire, including a Dollywood theme park.
I protest in my own way through my songs. I actually am able to speak for women and for myself, and I had it easier than most because I was confident in myself and either too dumb to know or to think about it in any other way that I had a talent that I thought could make us all a bunch of money, and that's what I go into business meetings with men. Of course, I've been hit on all my life, and especially in those early days, but I knew how to manage that myself. I never sold out, never did anything that was going to take away from who I was as a human being. I don't care if you're, like I say, black or white or whatever. I don't care if you're gay or lesbian or transgender. Everybody should have an equal chance.
You have said a couple times, you've been quoted as saying anyway, that you didn't want to look old, which of course you do not. But is there anything good about getting older, do you think?
Some good things about getting older is that you can look back on your life and see what you've accomplished and see what you can do to help other people on their journey, which is what I'm doing right now. I want to live young. I want to think young. I want to do young. I want to always be important. I want to be useful. And as I've often said, I would much rather wear out than to rust out.
For someone in that rarefied group of entertainers to have received nominations for Grammy, Tony, Emmy, and Academy Awards, and has projects backed up for the future, rusting out seems highly unlikely.
She is a force of nature, one powerful woman. Thank you, Dolly Parton. And online, we look at the pledge that Joe Biden and his team have taken to achieve gender parity in the male-dominated world of national security and the groups that have been helping the team achieve it. You can find that story on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that is the NewsHour for this Friday night. I'm Judy Woodruff. Have a good, safe weekend. Thank you, and good night.